This is the time set for oral argument in the case of Randolph versus State, case number 73825. Sandra Stewart is representing the appellant. David Stanton is counsel for the respondents. And the argument, because it's a direct appeal in a death penalty case, we have set it for a full hour with 30 minutes per side. And so, Mr. Stanton, are you prepared to proceed? And how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
No, it's not him.
I'm sorry, Ms. Stewart. I misspoke. Are you prepared to proceed? You're on the wrong side of the courtroom for me. Are you prepared to proceed? And how much time would you like for rebuttal?
I am prepared to proceed, and I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, and you can see the clock clearly on your screen?
I can.
Very well.
Thank you, Ms. Chief Justice. May it please the court. The most telling comment by the prosecutor at trial of this case was his statement during closing argument in the penalty phase that Thomas Randolph deserves to die because Becky Randolph deserved to live. However, this case is about Sharon's death, not Becky's. Becky Randolph was Thomas Randolph's second wife, and she committed suicide in 1986, 22 years before the murder of Sharon Randolph, which is the subject of this case. It is undisputed that Sharon was murdered by Michael Miller. Thomas Randolph walked in his house to see Sharon lying on the floor in a pool of blood immediately after she had been shot by Miller. He then saw Miller. Thomas got his gun and shot and killed Miller. The state's theory is that Thomas Randolph hired Miller to kill Sharon, and then Thomas Randolph killed Miller to get rid of the only witness to this conspiracy. The threshold problem with the state's theory is that there was no evidence of a conspiracy between Thomas Randolph and Michael Miller to kill Sharon Miller. There was evidence that Michael Miller and Thomas Randolph were involved in selling prescription drugs. That was the only evidence of a conspiracy between Thomas Randolph and Michael Miller. There was no evidence of a conspiracy to kill Sharon Randolph. And in fact, during the grand jury proceedings, the grand jury specifically asked about the conspiracy issue and felt that there was not any evidence of a conspiracy to support the indictment. But the only way the state was able to get a conviction in this case was to portray Thomas Randolph as a serial wife killer. Thomas Randolph was married 6 times. 2 of his wives are still alive. 1 died of cancer. 1 died from complications following heart surgery. Becky, his second wife, committed suicide. And then we have this case where Sharon was murdered. Throughout the trial, the prosecutor suggested that Randolph killed 4 or 5 of his 6 wives. In fact, as stated previously, 2 are alive and 2 died of health problems. The prosecutor set about to revive the Utah case involving Becky's death and to admit evidence in that case against Randolph in this case involving Sharon's death by suggesting that Randolph killed Becky, and so he probably killed Sharon as well. Becky died in Utah and left a suicide note. Nevertheless, Detective Conley in Utah convinced a Utah prosecutor, Attorney McGuire, to prosecute Randolph for Becky's death, claiming it was staged. Randolph was acquitted in Utah, and all the files related to that trial were expunged. But Detective Conley, contrary to Utah law, kept the files from the Utah case for 22 years and gave those files to a Las Vegas Metro detective, O'Kelly, investigating the Sharon murder. Before the state could get before the jury evidence of the purported Becky killing, it had to clear two hurdles. First, it had to have a Petrocelli hearing where it could prove that it was likely that Randolph actually killed Becky. Second, they had to show that evidence of that killing was not being introduced to suggest that because Randolph killed Becky, he probably killed Sharon. The Petrocelli hearing in this case was flawed for two reasons. First of all, the Nevada court allowed the district attorney in Utah, McGuire, to testify under the case of Zanna v. State, which held that while expunged files could not be admitted, a person could testify about their memories of expunged events. His testimony was admitted to establish clear and convincing evidence that Randolph murdered Becky and that prior bad act should be admitted in the Sharon case. However, Zanna, a Nevada case, did not apply to Utah's expungement statute. Utah law precluded McGuire from testifying. The statute in that case states that a government agency or official may not divulge information or records which have been expunged. The Nevada statute regarding expungement, upon which Zanna was based, does not contain that preclusion. Instead, it pertains to how the person whose records have been expunged should be treated once those records are expunged. It states that the person can apply for a job without having to state that the crime which was expunged was ever committed. The second hurdle that the state had to clear in order to get the records of the Becky case into evidence was it had to prove that that evidence was relevant. In regards to the Petrocelli hearing, the state had access to 8 witness statements taken in 2008 by O'Kelly. Which had never been provided to the defense prior to the Petrocelli hearing, one of which was a statement by McGuire, which could have been used to cross-examine him at the Petrocelli hearing.
So, Ms. Stewart, you're saying that they were never provided to you, even in preparation of the Petrocelli hearing? The records were
That's
not
correct.
And was the objection made at the time of the hearing or a request for a continuance or some due process objection?
At the time of the Petrocelli hearing, the defense did not know that those statements existed. Now, during the course of the trial or the the representation of Mr. Randolph. He had several different attorneys. The state said that those statements had been provided to his prior attorneys when it came out after the Petrocelli hearing that the state had these 10 statements, one of which was the statement of McGuire. At that time, Randolph's attorneys cried foul and said those statements should have been provided to us prior to the Petrocelli hearing so that we could have used them to cross-examine McGuire. The state argued that they had been provided to a prior Randolph attorney, the current Randolph attorney after the Petrocelli hearing said that they were not provided to the prior Randolph attorney, and as evidence of that, pointed out to the court that the McGuire statement had not been used by the prior attorney at the Petrocelli hearing to cross-examine McGuire. Despite that, the court ruled that those statements had been provided to the defense prior to the Petrocelli hearing. The defense has always disputed that.
Ms. Stewart, I want to just confirm that McGuire was the sole witness who testified at the Petrocelli hearing. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And he was the prosecutor in the case in Utah. Is that right?
He was the prosecutor in the Utah case, yes.
And what was there a hearsay objection interposed or any effort to make the argument that because Mr. Randolph was later acquitted by the jury and then there's a judicial finding of deceptive practices by the investigator in the case in Utah, that somebody with personal knowledge should have testified at the Petrocelli hearing in the first instance? I understand they're often done on offers of proof, but it's concerning to me.
The defense attorneys did argue that Tarantino was the one that should be testifying at the Petrocelli hearing, and they wanted him to come. I don't remember a specific hearsay objection. I'd have to go back and look at the record, which is quite lengthy. I could further brief the court on that if it wants. But I do recall that the defense wanted Tarantino himself to come and testify at the Petrocelli hearing, and the state was vehement in its argument that McGuire was enough and that he should be allowed to testify.
Did Stewart? And Tarantino did come to trial and testify. I saw his testimony in Volume 17. So that was his first appearance and cross-examination by Randolph at the trial?
Correct.
Thank you.
Ms. Stewart, I have another question. Did the district court ever inquire into the first defense attorney or the defense attorney who the prosecutors claimed they gave that all of these witness statements and discovery to before the district court made a finding? How did the district court make a finding that they had the discovery prior to the Petrocelli?
It just assumed that. The prior attorney was from out of state. I forget which state, but by that time the trial court had no authority that I know of to order that attorney to come here.
Are you talking about Mr. Galanter?
I believe that's his name. It was the first attorney who was from a different state, and he was pro hac vicee. Okay. So the court was relying on what the current Randolph attorney was telling her, that they had been told by the prior attorneys that they never got those records. And the judge did not believe that.
But the second, the trial attorneys who were actually involved in Petrocelli were telling the district court they didn't have the records to, say, impeach these witnesses or this witness McGuire, and yet it still went forward as far as
correct
a burden of evidence without any impeachment or possible impeachment evidence.
That's correct. And the current attorneys, after the fact of the Petruccioli hearing, when they finally got the 10 statements, it was either 8 or 10 statements, one of which was McGuire's, they went back before the court and said, we did not have these at the time of the Petruccioli hearing. And if the attorneys had had those, they would have used those statements to cross-examine McGuire. Well, all of that was brought to the attention of the court. The court did not believe it. What the court thought, was that the first attorneys had simply gotten lost in their records and had not been given to the second attorneys.
But even if that were true, she didn't entertain perhaps reconsidering the Petruccioli hearing or having yet that witness come back to be cross-examined with the discovery?
No.
Are there inconsistencies between McGuire's testimony and the statement that was given? In other words, how would it have been material if you had it?
There were several inconsistencies, and those were outlined by the attorneys after the Petruccioli hearing when they received the statements, and those were brought out to the judge. I don't have that in front of me right now, but I did set those inconsistencies forth in the opening brief.
Ms. Stewart, this is Justice Gibbons in Las Vegas. Assuming we agreed with you in your Petruccioli argument, I'm sure Mr. Stanton's going to contend there's still overwhelming evidence to convict Mr. Randolph there. Why wouldn't it be considered harmless if there was error here?
Well, there wasn't overwhelming evidence to convict Randolph. First of all, as I stated before, there was no evidence of a conspiracy between Randolph and Miller. Without a conspiracy between Randolph and Miller, you can't get Randolph for a killing of Sharon. So, there was not overwhelming evidence of Randolph's guilt for this crime, for the killing of Sharon, and obviously he did kill Miller, but the defense theory is that he walked in, saw his wife in a pool of blood, and then saw a shadow in the darkness, and at that time did not even know that it was Miller, and shot who he thought was his wife's assailant.
Go ahead, Chief.
Sorry, this is Justice Pickering in Las Vegas. If there's some fuzziness in the record about the finding in Utah with respect to the prosecution on the Tarantino hit, if you will, and the alleged deceptive practices. And it looks like to me that the defense attached that to the opposition to the Petruccioli motion. And then there was some discussion about whether or not doing that opened up the door to the entire Utah record, except which the defense was also maintaining had been expunged. Did the defense withdraw the attachments to their opposition at the Petruccioli hearing or before it in order to avoid opening the door to the expungement records as a whole?
They did withdraw it at some point. I can't remember when.
Okay. And did they ever rescind that withdrawal?
Not that I know of.
So those records didn't go to the jury in this case?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Stewart, I was just going to ask, sorry, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. Miller, my understanding of the record is that there was testimony that he had made statements to his parents to the effect that he and Mr. Randolph were coming into some money close to the amount of the insurance soon and that he was going to be leaving town. Isn't that and the other testimony presented about numerous meetings that he was having with Randolph, some circumstantial evidence of a conspiracy?
Well, there was that statement that he made to his aunt and his uncle that he was going to be cutting into some money, he and Randolph. However, they were involved in selling prescription drugs. So it was never clear that that money that he was going to come into had anything to do with the murder of Sharon. There was absolutely no evidence that there was a conspiracy between Randolph and Miller for the murder of Sharon.
Ms. Stewart, this is Justice Hardesty in Carson City. I understand your arguments with respect to the Petrocelli hearing about the Utah case involving Becky. But it's my understanding that in addition to the Utah case involving Becky, there was also an admission as a prior bad act of Randolph's admission or plea of guilty to the witness tampering charge in Utah. Is that right? And wouldn't that have been relevant to the conspiracy charge against Randolph in this case?
All of the information regarding Tarantino was a red herring. Tarantino had no part in the death of Becky, and there was never any contention that he did. He was clear on the other side of the country, back east at the time, that Becky committed suicide. So there was never any argument that there was a conspiracy between Randolph and Tarantino for Tarantino to murder Becky, which is the nexus that you would have for this case, where they're claiming that there was a conspiracy between Randolph and Miller to kill Sharon.
So was the guilty verdict or the guilty plea and verdict in Utah regarding witness tampering admitted in this case?
It was.
And what was the explanation for the relevancy of that conviction being admitted in this case?
The judge says that the two were related because in both cases, Randolph was a friend of the person who's the testimony that was coming in. He was a friend of Tarantino. He was a friend of Miller. But where that falls apart is that in the Tarantino case, Tarantino was not involved in Becky's death.
Right.
But wasn't there evidence that Mr. Randolph had, in fact, solicited Tarantino to kill Becky?
Well, that's what Tarantino said, but that solicitation, supposedly for the life insurance money, according to Tarantino, came before Randolph was even married to Becky. So it was clear that Tarantino was not telling the truth in the Becky case, and the letters that we submitted that the court said shouldn't be allowed in that case proved that Tarantino was not telling the truth.
Sorry, this is Justice Kadish again.
Can I ask a question about this timer? Is that my total time remaining, or just for the 20 minutes?
No, it's your total time remaining. You're into your rebuttal time, Ms. Stewart.
Okay.
Sorry
but
about
can
that.
I save the rest of my time?
Yes, but Justice Kadish had a question pending. I think it was Justice Kadish.
Yes. So, sorry to use some more of your time, but to the extent there was an effort by the state during this trial to imply that not only that he had been involved in a conspiracy to kill Becky, but as to any others of his prior wives, was there any Petrocelli hearing about any of those allegations about any other prior wife that would allow him to present that as another bad act?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, you may reserve the balance of your time.
Yes, thank you.
Now it's your turn, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you. Justice Sizlik, I'd like to begin in review of the appellant's brief and the reply. There are a number of factual claims and procedural claims that I think are not supported by the record. And there are a number of them, but I wanted to just spend a few moments to address a couple that I think are critical. To begin with, on page 26 of the appellant's brief, in kind of the gravamen of citing to the authority that McGuire or anything from the Utah case could not have been testified to at trial, let alone the Petrocelli hearing, is the footnote is cited as 151, and it cites to a Utah Supreme Court case by the name of State versus Norris. I have the State versus Norris case. I've read it several times. There is nothing in that opinion that speaks to either this statute in question in Utah, both its predecessor and its current form. It has nothing to do with the discussion of any issue related to that statute or to anything related to this case whatsoever. I think that's important because the claim by the appellant that the Nevada statute would prevail in this matter and thus preclude the testimony either in a Petrocelli hearing or at trial is belied both by Nevada law and by the Utah statute itself. And so thus, the not only has the Utah Supreme Court, to my knowledge, ever interpreted that statute in the fashion that's argued to this court, but certainly there's nothing about this court's previous rulings in both Donlin and Zanna, which I think were the rule of law that directly applies to this issue, that would prohibit any of that testimony from Utah occurring in this case. The next one.
Could I pause you there, Mr. Stenton? This is Justice Pickering. When I read Zanna, though, it is addressing the idea that even though a conviction may be expunged, the witnesses who have firsthand knowledge of it don't lose their memory of it. So a victim, for example, remains a victim in her mind, and she could, that memory is ineradicable. But here, we don't have that. We have somebody whose knowledge, who came by the knowledge of the case through the state's investigation and prosecution of the case. Mr. McGuire was not a person with firsthand knowledge and a victim or a witness in the normal sense of I saw you drive through the red light or whatever. It wasn't a fact witness. It was an investigative, prosecutorial case development witness. So why wouldn't, as a matter of policy, that be distinguishable when you have an expunged record?
Because I think, Judge Pickering, if you look at both the Petrocelli hearing and at Mr. McGuire's trial testimony, his testimony on direct examination was very precisely elicited by Mr. Daskus at the Petrocelli hearing and by myself at trial. Mr. McGuire's questions and answers only related to his personal knowledge, both at the scene, which he went to, along with the detective. And Ms. Stewart, I think, misstated, understanding that she was not trial counsel, about Detective Conley. Detective Conley, once again, if you read his testimony, was not the detective on Becky's murder. He was the detective as it related to the attempt by the appellant to kill a critical state's witness pending trial for Becky's death in Utah. That's Detective Conley is the lead detective for the Tarantino case. So, Justice Pickering, McGuire's testimony was very closely and specifically tailored as to what he had personal knowledge of. It was not a relitigation of the facts of her death. Her death, although he was there to see the scene, was really not at issue or of interest of the state to litigate other than the fact that he suffered a single gunshot wound to the head. So that was not at any point questions asked of McGuire that would go beyond that.
So the next wasn't it argued that that testimony, or at least that testimony combined with Tarantino's, established that Randolph murdered Becky?
Well, whether it established whether he murdered them or not really wasn't at issue, obviously, not only in the trial, but for purposes of what the state sought permission and was granted permission by the trial court to admit what we refer to as the Utah case. It wasn't whether or not ultimately the jury felt it was murder, but it was the structure of what occurred leading up to Becky's death, which was hauntingly similar and thus triggered all the exceptions found by the trial court and the basis of the extended written ruling that she made as to why that was relevant. The grooming of Tarantino was the same as the grooming of Miller in this case, a relationship that had no other reason as it occurred to the Tarantino as a co-worker. Here, Miller's interaction with Randolph was maybe drugs, maybe some other activity, but the surrounding nature of how the solicitation to kill his then wife was almost precisely the same. And so we weren't relitigating whether or not Becky was murdered. It was what was done by Randolph prior to and leading up to her murder as it relates to Mr. Tarantino, number one. And number two, the explanation of why Miller was killed in this particular case. Because
if Becky had not been dead, if Becky were still alive, would you have been able to get that in?
Well, it may have been because of the similarity to the solicitation, that is how that process worked. But the death of Becky was not the important component of the Utah case. It was not only the lead up to it, but also the fact that Tarantino could have been the witness that was sufficient enough to convict him in Utah. It turns out that it wasn't, but that's certainly what Randolph was thinking as these recorded phone calls from Randolph and the testimony of his girlfriend at trial and the testimony of Tarantino, that it was clear, as Mr. Randolph admits, that he used the term to whack Tarantino. Now, he parenthetically now in the brief says, without any support in the record, that whack means beat up and not to kill. So what he learned from the Utah case that's now important to explain who Miller was and why Miller was killed.
Mr. Stanton, how?
But,
go ahead. Sorry, Chief.
Please go ahead. No, Justice Kadish, or was it Justice Stiglitz? I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Mr. Stanton, I've reviewed the judge's order in this regard, and it's still not clear to me how, well, she'll cite motive or intent. How is it not just propensity? Now, I'll give you an example with the motive being greed. You had the fact that in this instance, he took out almost $400,000 in life insurance. So there's a financial motive. How does that become more or less probable if we go back 20 years ago and he had a previous financial motive with a different person? How does that 20-year-old issue inform our current, the motive for this current offense, other than he tried to do it before and he's doing it again? Because that seems to be kind of, when I read it, it's a circle.
Well, because here it's not a matter of killing your wife for life insurance proceeds directly. Here you used a third party to commit that act.
Okay. So,
and thus.
Okay. So wait, but and I mean, cut you off, but that's the whole point. So 20 years ago, he used somebody to try to kill his wife, so therefore it's more likely that he did it again? Isn't that propensity?
No. No. He did it before. In order to, he had the financial motive in Becky's death. He solicited a third party to do it. That never panned out. But that behavior and planning for a financial reason of providing money and other things to the person that you're seeking to be the hitman was the exact same thing that had occurred here, not for a propensity purpose, but show that his killing of Miller was not as a good Samaritan trying to defend his wife and him, but that it was a pre-planned thing that had occurred with one additional step, the fact that he learned from his Utah case, and that is, don't leave any witnesses alive.
Do you think you could approve this case without this prior?
I'm not sure whether or not I've ever assessed this case in that way. I think the fact of Mr. Randolph's statement, his walkthrough video, and how that failed to withstand simple physics, that is, of forensics, ballistics, and forensic pathology, was, I think, a damaging set of facts from his mouth. But once again, that spoke to what he claimed was the scenario. It does not speak to what Miller's role was in this entire case. And that's why the Utah case, look, if there's uncharged misconduct, prior bad act, if 48045 subsection 2 has any meaning, it's in a case like this. Because
Justice Silver, why not wait until the defense after opening and use this in rebuttal? Why risk in a death case to put this type of propensity evidence in a case in chief?
Well, first of all,
let me just finish. Ultimately, he gave a statement to the police. Opening is probably going to follow that. And then you could present it in a rebuttal case.
Well, first of all, it's not propensity evidence. It is evidence that for almost half a dozen elicited, articulated exceptions under 48045 subsection 2 clearly fit in this particular case. And it changes the context of what was claimed by Randolph in this case, coming in trying to save his wife and to save himself. If the similarities between Utah and this case weren't as striking, then I think your point is might have some more significance into a strategic trial decision. But this was on no less than six criteria met on any way you could possibly look at this case. It fit. And so then what's the purpose of that statute in a case which factually and legally is so strong? The next thing I'd like to point out, because this is, I think, important, because it's mentioned six times in the opening brief. It was mentioned by counsel in oral arguments and about half the time in the reply. This is found on page 32 of the appellant's brief, and it says, the Utah Attorney General and the courts, and by that it means the Utah courts, found that Tarantino was a liar and that the whole prosecution of Randolph was unfounded and maliciously interrogated. Now, the only basis that claim is made about Utah case and the citation throughout it is Record of Appeal, Volume 2, page 411. And I'm holding that document in my hand right here. This is an unsigned order from the Second Judicial District Court in Utah. It's not signed, but it does indicate that there's a file stamped and that it was filmed. I assume that's a reference to its archival. And what happens? Let me just preface what's occurring before this order happens. This is from the judge who hears the Randolph murder in Utah and also hears the plea of Randolph of guilt to the witness tampering charge. He sentences Randolph to prison. This is a motion by Randolph asking the court to reconsider that sentence, and he wants to provide evidence to the court that would support his sentence being reconsidered. And it says, in the first paragraph that procedural. And then I think this portion of the order is inartfully drawn, and I'll explain why. Now, the second paragraph is what's pronounced and paraded in the briefs about a finding of the Utah court that somehow Tarantino and or McGuire are unreliable. It's clear from what happens in this order that that's not the case whatsoever. And it says, it describes what I think the evidence. Now, number one, we don't know what this evidence is, but it comes from Randolph. And then here's the court's ruling. Nothing that I have read has changed my mind about the sentence in this case. The prison was the appropriate remedy. The motion to review the sentence and place you on probation is denied. And the reason why I think my interpretation is clearly correct is if anything in paragraph 2 had been an actual finding by the Utah court, it would have never still pronounced its prison sentence to be appropriate, let alone that it was going to reconsider the sentence altogether.
But isn't that the evidence that they also withdrew because they didn't want to open the expungement issue?
No, Judge, this is the judge in Utah sentencing Mr. Randolph for the tampering with a witness back in the late 1980s.
Okay, but I thought that was what they withdrew. That's part of this record, then? You're saying volume 2, 411 is part of the record and they did not withdraw that?
Well, yes, because that's what's argued 6 times in the appellate brief and half of the reply brief, arguing that there was not clear and convincing evidence to permit Judge Miley to making her extended written order in this case. And then finally, on page 64, under the category of prosecutorial misconduct, under subsection 2, citing that says, in January 2009, the prosecutor told the grand jury that Randolph had been married 6 times and 4 of his wives were now dead and 3 of them died under suspicious circumstances. Once again, page 64, and it cites as the authority of that footnote 284. 284 is a transcript, not before the grand jury, but the return of the indictments before the chief judge, and it's an argument about what bail should be had in this case. So once again, those are just 3, and I'm just and I didn't want to take too much of my time, but I've seen I've taken half of my time to explain that I would urge the court and its staff to be very careful about the claims of facts that exist in this case, at least as it's articulated in the brief and the reply brief, because I think the facts are very important in this case and are important to get correct.
So, Mr. Stanton, this is Justice Kadish. So I just want to be clear. If you're saying that you weren't trying to present to the jury that Mr. Randolph actually committed the murder of Becky, so what is it that was established by clear and convincing evidence to come in under Petrocelli? Is it that he solicited Tarantino to kill Becky? Is it that he hired somebody else to kill Tarantino? Or what is it that were the other bad acts that you were that were found clear and by clear and convincing evidence and not substantially more prejudicial than probative?
That prior to his wife's death, he had solicited Tarantino to kill his wife. That he had done that in a grooming process, that he had done it in a short but very intensive way, both by emotion, by manipulation, and the similarity between what the jury was able to see in 3 dimensions from Mr. Tarantino, a very small, slight individual who was very young and a co-worker of Mr. Randolph at the time. Once again, the focus both in our written application to the court seeking admission of the Utah case, the court's finding and ruling, and the actual presentation at trial never focused on whether or not Becky Randolph was murdered. It was focused on the circumstances surrounding it. It focused on the fact that Tarantino, as you could imagine in Utah, was a compelling and critical witness as to whether or not Becky Randolph's murder was death was a suicide or a murder. And so in this particular case, the death of Miller is that Randolph had learned from the Tarantino-Becky case in Utah not to leave any witnesses alive. And the evidence that showed how Miller was killed, the fact that he did not have the ski mask on, the last two shots were while Randolph was standing right over him after he had been shot three times in the torso, and that the headshots were him standing straight over the body. Once again, Randolph claims that Miller had the ski mask on. There's no forensic material at all on that ski mask that would prove or show that that mask was worn at the time that any of the shots entered his body or entered his head.
Mr. Stanton, what's your response to Ms. Stewart's claim regarding the discovery prior to the Petrocelli? I'm assuming that your response, at least on the first part, was that you did turn it over to the ProHoc attorney. But secondly, let's just assume you did turn it over to the first attorney and they failed to give it to trial counsel. What's your response that they didn't have the discovery during the Petrocelli, and when asking the court after the Petrocelli to, you know, reconsider opening it back up for cross, what's your response to that argument?
Well, first of all, the attorneys initially hired by Mr. Randolph were Yale Galanter out of Florida and Brent Bryson, who was a local counsel here and, for all I know, still is in the Nevada area. That information was absolutely provided to them. They could have called either one of them at any time, certainly Mr. Bryson, any of his subsequent counsels, and it must be clear that they made repeated efforts to relitigate Judge Miley's ruling on all three of the teams of lawyers that represented Mr. Randolph prior to trial and through trial. The record is replete with repeated efforts to revisit her ruling, and the ruling to include these documents, because Justice Silver, it's quite clear within a year or so after the Petrocelli hearing that this counsel had these documents. It did not then and would not now, when you look at those documents, have affected anything that would have occurred in the Petrocelli hearing, because ultimately Justice Miley said, I made the finding that it was clear and convincing evidence for these reasons of the state. I've narrowly tailored not only the evidence, but the reasons and the purposes of this evidence coming in at trial. I've reviewed what you claimed you didn't have when McGuire initially testified, and it did not affect then or now in all the repeated attempts for her to reconsider her ruling. So
but if they're saying,
whether
if they're saying they didn't have discovery, and I don't know, I'm not just saying, if they saying they didn't have discovery, it's real easy to make clear and convincing the state's case. They didn't. If they did not, and I don't know, if they did not have impeachment material, which could have brought it below clear and convincing, don't you think that's concerning? And why dig your heels in? Why not just give it to them? Hand it right there in the middle of court. This is a death case.
It was already provided to them, and the district court made a finding of that fact. So it's not just
saying,
my opinion.
But if they're saying, Mr. Stanton, we don't have it, this is a death case, and we don't have that discovery, then what is the harm in you actually handing them the discovery and allowing them time to possibly rebut this clear and convincing? If you've only presented one side, then how do we know that truly was clear and convincing if they didn't have the discovery?
Because both of those things happened. They were given the discovery timely yet again, as you suggested. And not only that, but as I've just been saying, they repeatedly requested, after receiving that discovery and reviewing it, they repeatedly requested of Judge Miley to revisit her opinion. And she said no, because the nature and the quality of that discovery that you're alluding to did not and would not change her opinion as to whether or not the clear and convincing standard had been met.
So if you had impeachment evidence that somebody was convicted of a felony, that wouldn't matter? She'd already found clear and convincing, so that's the end of it? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying that at all. She reviewed the arguments that counsel had suggested would change her mind about her finding of clear and convincing, and she said it wouldn't. And when you look at the documents, it's clear that it wouldn't change any reasonable jurist's opinion about whether or not this met the clear and convincing standard. I mean, this is all evidence that was testified to by a percipient eyewitness to all the events that occurred in Utah. And the claims of that this evidence impeached McGuire or Tarantino had nothing to do with the court's finding that this met the clear and convincing standard. It was certainly...
If it's all just percipient, why wouldn't you just hand it over right then and there? If it's all just nothing... Maybe I'm not understanding that part of why discovery may or may not have been given to trial counsel.
I think we're two ships passing in the night. I'm saying yet again, that discovery was provided to the second set of attorneys within a short period of time after they claimed they had they didn't have that discovery at the time of the Petrocelli hearing. But once again, the clear and convincing standard to permit the prior bad act evidence coming in is also for the jury to then assess from the petite jury in this case. So whether or not, and the defense's opportunity to cross-examine McGuire and Tarantino occurred in front of the 12 in this particular case. So in the other issue that I think is important for the court to understand about this is that all of the arguments of the exceptions found by Judge Miley go unanswered both in the brief or in the reply, in the sense that they don't rebut that all these exceptions not only apply but also are found in this case and in the Utah case. Now, for example, one of the claims that it doesn't apply is that in the Becky murder in Utah, Tarantino wasn't involved in the murder, and obviously Miller was. But obviously, for purposes of a prior bad act, that's a difference that doesn't have much, if at all, any substance in determining whether or not this is a prior bad act that fits within the statute and within the case law in the state of Nevada as to whether or not they're similar enough in nature and relevant to the trial in this particular case. Every single one of those cases show that indeed this prior bad act met every one of those exceptions.
Sorry, I just want to clarify kind of some of the facts about this. My understanding is that there was evidence that Mr. Randolph solicited some undercover law enforcement officer to kill Mr. Tarantino. But even with that solicitation of supposedly an undercover law enforcement officer, he ends up pleading to a misdemeanor tampering with a witness? That suggests to me there might have been some problems with the evidence. Do you know anything more about how it went from soliciting a murder to a misdemeanor?
I don't know the historical reasons of the thoughts of both, because obviously it was a plea between Mr. Randolph's counsel in Utah and the prosecutor up in Utah. I don't know the background enough, nor is there, once again, we were very cautious in not reviewing documents from Utah that might have answered that question. Certainly in our interviews of any of the witnesses that we used, there was no clear explanation to that. I don't know that it was a misdemeanor when you said that, because once again, there's certain critical things, like the expungement order is not part of this record. The plea is not part of this record that I've ever seen. And so I don't know that it was a misdemeanor. I know he was sentenced to prison because that's the order that I take exception with of anybody, let alone the Utah Attorney General or the trial court making a finding about the credibility of these witnesses.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions from Carson City of Mr. Stanton? Mr. Gibbons? Yeah. Ms. Stewart, you have 6 minutes and 33 seconds remaining.
You're muted,
Ms. Stewart.
You're muted. Ms. Stewart, you're muted.
I'm so sorry.
No, don't apologize. That's fine.
You can hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. The state just argued that admission of evidence regarding Becky's death wasn't important, that the important thing was admission of evidence of Randolph's conversations with Tarantino when they were out shooting about how to commit the perfect murder type thing. However, as I stated, if it wasn't important, then we have to wonder why the state said in its closing argument that Thomas Randolph deserves to die because Becky Randolph deserved to live.
What was that, the guilt phase or the penalty phase, ma'am?
That was in the penalty phase.
Thank you.
It's the defense position that the whole Tarantino issue was a red herring. Tarantino played no part in Becky's death. And that is undisputed. Tarantino was living back east when Becky died. Becky left a suicide note. Randolph was prosecuted for that murder, and he was acquitted after a trial.
Where is the proof of that acquittal in this record?
It's undisputed that he was acquitted and that all those documents were expunged. I don't think that the state would dispute that.
Okay, but the volume 2, 411 that Mr. Stanton alludes to, and then the next page is a letter from the Attorney General. Can you address his argument with respect to those documents?
I'm not sure what documents he's referring to. I really can't. The other thing is
Let me just ask one follow-up. Where in this record do you establish that Tarantino was deemed a liar in Utah?
Well, one of the things that illustrates that Tarantino was a liar is that he testified at trial, I believe it was, that Randolph had talked to him about killing Becky, and I forget what the year was, but it turned out that was before Randolph was even married to Becky. And yet the reason that he supposedly was talking to Tarantino about killing Becky was for life insurance proceeds. People all the time talk about committing the perfect murder. You know, Tarantino talked to Miller or to Randolph about perfect ways to murder your wife and went through different scenarios. But Tarantino was nowhere in Nevada when Becky died. So the cases are so dissimilar that it makes no sense that whatever happened with Tarantino and Becky 22 years previously would have any bearing on the death of Sharon.
Is there anything to the similarities that Mr. Stanton pointed to and that the judge apparently found persuasive? Does that go to establishing motive, intent,
absence of mistake or accident, those sorts of exceptions under 48045.
The judge said that the Becky information was admissible to show knowledge because in both instances, Randolph knew the man who shot his wife. That makes no sense. First of all, Becky was not shot by a third person. The theory in Utah was that Randolph shot Becky. And certainly it can't be that just because you know somebody, that makes it admissible that whatever happened with that person 22 years ago is admissible in a case today. She also said that there was a common plan because Becky supposedly was killed by Randolph while Sharon was supposedly killed in an elaborate conspiracy scheme. There was no plan in 1986 to kill Miller or Sharon. The court also said it was admissible to show that Randolph did not kill Miller in self-defense, but to get rid of a witness in a plot. But there was no plot with a third person to kill Becky, who was supposedly killed by Randolph himself. There was no issue of identity in the Sharon case. It was undisputed that Miller killed Sharon, and then Randolph killed Miller. So there was really no valid purpose under 4805 for admitting the bad act evidence. Now, the court asked the state whether or not there was other evidence that was compelling that could have convicted Randolph without the prior bad act evidence. The state referred to the walkthrough. Maybe that was sufficient. Who knows? The walkthrough happened at a time, I believe it was within a week of the murder. Also, Randolph was on a lot of medications at the time. Also, in the course of a murder or a killing, there's a lot of adrenaline going, people move, and you can get things wrong. But in any case, we don't know. We don't know if that was sufficient, but that's the whole issue in this case. Have a new trial where that evidence is not admitted and see if the walkthrough and the other evidence is sufficient. This is a man's life we're talking about, and the Becky evidence should have never come in.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both counsel for their briefs and oral argument in this matter. We appreciate it, and the matter will stand submitted and will be in recess.